This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day, and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the den of espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year, to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just, I think, controversial.
That's a fact. That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what... It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people, pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
There is recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We are definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's while prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts have warned the drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. They discussed cooperation relations, in which Assad described ties between both states as an alliance of will in the face of Western hegemony. During the meeting, the Syrian president touched upon the threats of Turkey to launch a new offensive in Syria. Assad said Turkish pretexts for an aggression on Syria are false, misleading, and disconnected from reality, stressing that they violate the UN Charter and international law. Amir Abdullahian said Assad's recent visit to Tehran constituted a turning point in Syrian-Iranian relations. He added that Israeli attacks on Syria are part of the terrorist war on the country. The top Iranian official noted that Iran is ready to help settle misunderstandings between Damascus and Ankara.
Any foreign intervention in Syria complicates the situation. We understand Turkish concerns over border issues. The solution lies in dialogue between Syrian and Turkish security officials. I understand from my talks with the Turks that they prioritize a political solution.
Amir Abdullahian also had a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. He expressed optimism over solving the Turkish-Syrian conflict peacefully, asserting Iran will exert all efforts to prevent any conflict in Syria. Maqdad welcomed Iran's efforts.
Any solution that leads to Turkey's retreat from Syrian territories, stopping its attacks on the country, and ending Turkey's support to terrorist groups is welcomed. We trust the Islamic Republic of Iran, but not the other side.
Miqdad reiterated Syria's determination to eliminate terrorism and thanked Iran for its support. He stressed that Israel must realize that Syria will not remain silent over Israeli aggressions. The visit shows the depth of ties between the two allies and the crucial role Iran plays in the region, as it comes hours after an Israeli attack on Syria and amid speculations that Turkey is going to launch a military operation in the Arab country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The town of Alamskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as a town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming, the boom of outgoing artillery. Two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon, so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 metres or 100 metres around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad, my nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Prokhodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy, and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milov-Golovka.
In the limelight.
This month, the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, COI, on the occupied Palestinian territories found that the ongoing Israeli regime occupation of Palestine is the root cause of the decades-long conflict in the region. But as the probe gets underway, the Israel Lobby's flagship organization, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, is actively attempting to extinguish it. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How APAC is Leading Efforts to Dismantle the UN Inquiry on Palestine. Here's the story. This month, the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, COI, on the occupied Palestinian territories found that the ongoing Israeli regime occupation of Palestine is the root cause of decades-long conflict in the region.
But as the probe gets underway, the Israel lobby's flagship organization, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, is actively attempting to extinguish it. In response to the inquiry led by the UN Human Rights Council, UNHRC, members of Congress have initiated legislation to abolish the investigation in both the House and the Senate. On June 14th, Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Nevada, Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen introduced the COI Elimination Act S-4389. The bill is similar but not identical to H.R. 7223, also called the COI Elimination Act, introduced by Representatives Gregory Stoop, Vincent Gonzalez, and Joe Wilson in March. Both bills seek to abolish the UN inquiry as well as other groups in order to combat systematic anti-Israel bias at the United Nations Human Rights Council and other international fora. The legislation also calls for restricting U.S. funding to the UNHRC by 25% of the amount budgeted. While the Senate bill only has 3 co-sponsors currently, the House version has nearly 70 signatories made up of mostly Republican representatives. The UN inquiry came as a result of the Israeli regime attacks on Gaza and occupied East Al-Quds in May 2021, with the purpose of investigating human rights abuses that occurred during that period. The United States, the Zionist regime, and 19 other countries have sharply condemned the inquiry following the release of its first report. U.S. Ambassador to UNHRC Michelle Taylor said during the 50th session of the Human Rights Council in Geneva, as the UN inquiry's first report was being debated, "We believe the nature of COI established last May is further demonstration of long-standing disproportionate attention given to Israel in the Council and must stop." The U.S. State Department has also rebuked the U.N. inquiry, its spokesperson Ned Price remarking, "We firmly oppose the open-ended and vaguely defined nature of the U.N. Human Rights Council's Commission of Inquiry on the situation in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, which represents a one-sided, biased approach that does nothing to advance the prospects for peace," unquote. The UNHCR did not respond to press queries on the congressional bills, instead reiterating the COI's goals and that all member states must abide by its actions. However, a UNHCR spokesperson did tell Mint Press News that the mandate of the Commission of Inquiry was supported by a majority of member states of the Council, and the allocation of a budget was then approved by the General Assembly. All members of the Human Rights Council are expected to fully cooperate with its decisions, as reaffirmed in General Assembly Resolution 50251 of 2005. According to Jewish Insider, APAC has spent this month lobbying on Capitol Hill for more members of Congress to support the COI Elimination Act as part of its first in-person National Council meeting in Washington, D.C. since the start of the pandemic. Their efforts appear to have succeeded as nearly 40 House representatives signed onto the bill over the last 2 weeks. It's simply another APAC-driven effort to demonize the UN in order to obfuscate the cruel and inhumane realities on the ground in Palestine and to deny the apartheid nature of the Israel, historian Walter L. Hickson told Mint Press News. The author of Israel's Armor, Israel Lobby, and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict, Hickson, explained that APAC activists don't have a secret lobbying tactic, but rather pressure members of Congress through their financial clout. It's what they always do, he said, adding they let them know that people who support them can get support from AIPAC, and people who oppose them can expect their next campaign opponents to be funded by AIPAC. Hickson added it's pretty ruthless lobbying that exerts its influence, and unfortunately, there are a lot of members of Congress who are very easily swayed, unprincipled, fearful, and toe the AIPAC line. In addition to lobbying members of Congress directly, AIPAC is also encouraging Americans to urge their representatives to support the legislation. Yet, they're not the only Israel lobby organization tackling the COI. Richard Goldberg, senior advisor at the Israel Lobby Group Foundation for Defense of Democracies, published an op-ed in the New York Post railing against the COI. Pro-Israel groups B'nai B'rit, International Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, and the National Jewish Advocacy Center have also come out against the COI. AIPAC has also pressured Congress on other issues during their recent Capitol Hill tour, such as continuing military aid to the Zionist regime, supporting the Stop Iranian Drones Act, and rejecting a Senate letter urging the U.S. government to investigate the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Sent last week, a letter signed by nearly half of the Democrats serving in the Senate calls on President Biden to directly involve the U.S. in probing Aghaleh's killing. AIPAC talking points sent to lawmakers ahead of the letter's publication and seen by Israeli newspaper Haaretz said the circumstances surrounding the death of Abu Aghaleh remain unclear despite the hasty conclusions of various media outlets, whereas the letter implies both Israeli culpability and inability to conduct an objective, thorough investigation of the incident, unquote. While the COI Elimination Act has received significant backing, the bill's stated purpose is far-fetched. The U.S. cannot, with the stroke of a pen, unilaterally eradicate a rogue agency investigation. However, according to Hickson, the country does have considerable control over the UN, and by withholding a quarter of funding, as promised within the bill, can prove detrimental to the UN's efforts. Whether the bill comes to fruition remains to be seen, but Hickson believes it has a chance, especially given that Democrats are signing onto it as well. Currently, 9 Democrats have sponsored the House version, and Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal has signed onto the Senate Act. Israel lobby experts have suggested that AIPAC's influence on Capitol Hill is waning as more Democratic politicians and American Jews become increasingly critical of the Zionist regime actions. For example, experts have speculated that AIPAC establishing political action committees last year is just a desperate attempt to cement its authority over Washington politics. While Hickson agrees, he also asserts that AIPAC still remains quiet, influential, and with in-person lobbying again a feature of AIPAC's work as pandemic restrictions dissipate, the organization may continue to see its influence balloon. He said AIPAC is very determined. They have increased their funding. They have increased their office space. They have increased their number of personnel. It remains a very powerful lobby, not just for a foreign policy, for a foreign country, but period. It's as powerful as any lobby really in Washington, and probably more powerful than the gun lobby. Nevertheless, public support for the Zionist regime has waned substantially in the last decade, mirrored by an increasing sympathy for the Palestinian cause, especially among Democrats. According to a February Gallup poll, sympathy for Israelis has declined from 64% to 55% from 2013 to 2022, and climbed from 12% to 26% for Palestinians. While the Zionist regime might be losing the battle for public opinion, in the realm of political influence in Washington, it is still winning the war.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A Bank of England report warning the economic outlook for the UK and the rest of the world has deteriorated materially. It calls the British economy very uncertain. British households have been paying more for energy, food and fuel recently, mainly due to the economic fallout of the Ukraine war. Now, experts believe that the inflation rate in Britain could surpass 11% later this year. Elsewhere in Europe, powerhouse Germany posting a monthly trade deficit for the first time in three decades. Germany's Federation of Trade Unions has warned that the short supply can lead to the collapse of entire industries if it remains unresolved. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najafi. We're going to discuss the fallout of the Ukraine war in Europe. Joining me in this episode will be historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Tony, beginning with you, to what extent has the Ukraine war contributed to rising energy prices and the cost of living crisis in Europe?
Well, I can't really speak for Europe. I can certainly speak for the UK. And I'm not so sure that the Ukraine war has contributed much. What has contributed is the excessive, relentless sanctions being piled on Russia from the West. And this has made, obviously, a big difference in confidence. So as soon as you get you know, a government saying, oh, we're not going to be trading with this part of the world, what happens is it has a knock-on effect on all your various businesses, not just the lack of actual trade, because, of course, there is still trade going on between Russia and Europe in terms of the fuel, which is still going, the gas, which is still going. These are the major things. I think what's the main problem here is these new green taxes which they've been implementing at the same time. We were told here in the UK and across Europe and the United States back in the last autumn 2021, we were told there's going to be a big hike in gas prices and fuel prices, but we weren't told why. Now we know. And I would suggest that they knew that the conflict in Ukraine was going to break out way back in 2021. And that actually over Christmas, what we saw here was a new green tax. I would call it a fascist green tax, a green fascist tax put onto petrol and diesel here in Britain, an extra 20 pence a litre. What happened is the oil companies raised their prices before Christmas, and when the new tax came in over Christmas, they dropped their prices so that no one would notice the new tax. This is the BPs and the Shells doing this. And so this has, I think, been the main driver of inflation. And of course, this, what it does is it really makes it much more difficult for the small and medium businesses to survive. They're having to pay more and more just to get around. So if you put, I mean, this is one basic thing of economics which doesn't seem to have got through to the British politicians or the finance journalists in London, for obvious reasons, is that they don't like to upset the finance people in London, the journalists. It is that you, what you've done is you've increased everything. By increasing the price of fuel, you increase the price of almost everything. Goods, manufactured goods, services, food, all has to be distributed. So you're adding on to the price of that by increasing the cost of fuel. And I think that's the main driver behind this, rather than the actual Russian action. But what they're trying to do, as they always do, is to blame somebody else for their own problems. I think the biggest question in all of this has got to be why these enormous sanctions have been put onto Russia, because of what was actually the Russian intervention in a civil war, which the NATO countries had been fueling for many years. Victoria Nuland in the United States pouring $5 billion into seeing the coup in 2014, for example. She admitted to that herself. So there was a civil war which was started over in the Ukraine, and the attempt has been to blame all of the problems which are being put onto the West, domestic populations in Europe, the United States, and here in Britain, an attempt to blame this on Russia, because they simply will not admit that what they're doing is damaging their own people.
Okay. Now, John Bosnich, I just wanted to ask you about, let's take a look at the bigger picture. Let's see how this Ukraine war has impacted Europe as a whole. Then we'll come to Britain and then later on to Germany and others.
Okay, well, I mean, we know already, and I appreciate the comments of your other guest, Tony Gosling, because he's right on the money here. Every war is an opportunity to camouflage another domestic problem. And so this is correct. It's an opportunity for the English government and for European governments to blame Russia for unsolved infrastructure problems within their own economies. Mm-hmm. And no better than to blame it now on Russia than to have to try and explain to the public that you made a mistake yourselves. So right. That's a correct starting point. But on the longer term, what we're seeing here is that this war represents a shift in power globally. And this is the actual end of the line for the make war and take over countries approach that the United States, the so-called Anglo-American Empire, has been pursuing since Britannia ruled the waves. We have a situation here where there's either going to be devastating nuclear war, not two nuclear bombs like World War II, but a devastating nuclear war that's going to change the face of the planet, or there's going to be cooperation between nations in our common interest. And this has been forced upon us by the American push, with the support of England, with the support of London and the military regime there, and the military regime, and I call them both military regimes, because basically the number one business of the Anglo-American Empire is war. Everything else is just feeding the people while we prepare for the next war. Mm-hmm. This is the turning point. Are we going to pursue an economic plan for the world based on taking from other people or based on sharing technologies and working together for the future? That's where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Now, Tony, let's take a look at Britain now. The cost of living crisis, together with the rising inflation, has taken a heavy toll on the economy, as you know. And there is this new report that's painting an even darker picture for the country's economic situation. So what do you anticipate is awaiting British economy?
Well, the signs are not good. Of course, there will be an attempt to blame all this on Brexit, as the British economy has its problems. I've seen the people fighting back here. We saw just yesterday, in the beginning of July 2022, we saw lorry drivers blockading. What they're doing is they're driving very slowly along motorways. They're not actually making sure that nobody can move anywhere, that they're making the point by driving slowly together on all three lanes of the motorway, or two lanes together, that people are not going to put up with these fuel price hikes. And actually what's going on, of course, is what the oil cartels have been trying to do for many decades. Governments have been reining them back and trying to stop them doing this, which is simple. It's called price fixing. The fact is that the oil cartels have become so powerful, and actually they are some of the wealthiest businesses, or in any institutions, in some ways more wealthy than governments. They've got more money to throw around than the governments do. Is that they're now using that power to do things like restrict the supply, as they did last autumn here in Britain. And so what's happening is there is a bit of a fight back going on from ordinary people getting together and telling the government that we know you've got a very powerful oil lobby. We are people and we are a lobby too. So listen to us. But the prospects are not good here in Britain or in other parts of Europe. And as you mentioned at the start, this is very shocking to see the Germans return their first for many, many years trade deficit. So that means that the Germans are importing more than they're exporting. Mm-hmm. Germany, let's not forget, is the manufacturing hub of Europe. So what we're seeing is the geopolitical plates shifting, tectonic plates completely changing. So the pattern that's been building up since the Second World War is now changing, a bit like something as important as the fall of the Berlin Wall. The prospects in Britain are not good, and I think we need to understand why that is. And the reason is because we have adopted this Anglo-Zionist Empire attitude of finance capitalism. That is to say, money rules the world, and the people with the money make all the decisions. They have the power to keep their money offshore, for example, so it doesn't get taxed, and they can accumulate more and more. And when they start to become billionaires, then they set up these foundations, tax-free foundations, so they can funnel the money into those and use those for political change and propaganda. Basically, think places like the Wellcome Trust, the Bill and Melinda, the finance sector needs to be very strongly regulated or owned. Things like water, also we have telecommunication monopoly. These things need to be controlled by openly and publicly. And we're also talking gas and electricity industries. Countries like Russia and many others around sovereign countries going to keep control of these. And the person who's made this fight between finance capitalist countries and industrial has got to be the American economist Michael Hudson. By the way, he owns Chinese universities too. So this is well understood, completely shut out by the London and by the finance journalists. Some point they will start getting educated on this, and that what we're fighting, because of course we are fighting this within Britain as well. We don't want taken over and controlled individuals. We want to control and own them for them.
Okay, John, let's take a look at Germany now. The rare deficit in Germany is blamed on international supply chains and record energy prices, and this is said to be partially triggered by Russia's cutting back on supplying natural gas to Europe. And Germany relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas needs. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that it is in part a fuel shortage issue, but these countries have strategic reserves, and the conflict in Ukraine has not been going on long enough to deplete the strategic reserves of Germany. So we have a more complex problem here than simply a supply and demand problem. What we have here is a general refocusing of the economic center of this planet. And this has been going on for some time now, but the economic motor force of this planet has already shifted to China. It is no longer Germany. Germany is still the motor center of the economy of Europe. And when Germany shows a deficit, that means that the entire Europe is going to be going down the tubes economically shortly. So those who wish to survive will be turning to China. They will be turning to China for cheaper quality, cheaper goods with similar quality. China will be able to outproduce Germany. China has already licensed large elements of German productive capacity. Germany has sold these licenses to China, and China has factories that have supply of fuel, a steady, stable supply of fuel from Russia directly by pipeline. And this is going to be the tipping factor that's going to tip the scales away from Europe as the center of the world. And it won't be so long, you know, our grandchildren, if not our children, will be looking at atlases of the world in which Europe is no longer the center. Europe will be on one edge, America and South America will be on the other edge, and the Eurasian landmass centering around Russia, India, and China will be at the center of every world map. This is just the start.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we talked about problems, Jim, and Tony, let's now take a look at actually ways that we could actually resort to address the economic woes in Europe. Slapping sanctions on top of sanctions on Moscow, which pushes Russia to take more tit-for-tat measures, is that the way?
Well, actually, Russia has been quite good in not taking tit-for-tat measures. They have done with their diplomats over the years, but the Russians are doing everything they can. They're bending over backwards to have decent relations with the West. You know, they have understood that there's been 15,000 people killed in the Donbass region in Ukraine, which is why they felt it necessary to intervene over the last 8 years. And that aspect of this isn't really covered at all in the Western media. So the Russians, I think, have not been just taking one measure for another. They're seeing this as something where, OK, so if the West wants to play these games, and I think actually the West, by the way, if you want to look it up, is using game theory here, that what they're doing is they're saying, let's imagine having a war game about this and who can win and who can't. And they're following these ideas, economic warfare and military warfare games, in order to try and beat the Russians, almost like using a chess computer or something, this kind of thing. But at the end of the day, the populations are watching all of this, and they're seeing the credibility of the West slide down. So, I think that the Russians have been much more mature, and the Chinese, in many ways, just simply taking what the West has been trying to do without big retaliation. That's because, of course, they are winning the economic war, if you want to see it like that. They have a very strong natural resource bases. They have a very good and efficient, well-regulated economy and manufacturing bases where individuals can actually get access to new people starting in the market. What we've got in the West is basically a series of rackets or cartels that are controlling industries, are price fixing. And, you know, this is really the way that big empires go down. And we're seeing that, of course, with the United States. Slowly but surely, countries around the world are realizing, well, we cannot trust putting our money into Washington or London because then it may well be seized. So that money is slowly but surely, and that wealth is moving around the world to these new power centers that John was talking about, away from Washington. And the Anglo-Zionist Empire is basically shooting itself in the foot by having such a ridiculous overreaction. That overreaction is aimed at its domestic population. But I don't think necessarily that propaganda is going to work in the long term. It's really a desperate measure, and I think it indicates just how desperate the deep state, the ruling elite in the West now is.
Okay. John, let me ask you a question about the U.S., and then if we have time, another I'll put in a question to Tony about Europe. Now, President Biden blaming Russia for the rising fuel price in the U.S., and so far he's earmarked, you know, $7 billion of American taxpayer money, you know, into aiding Ukraine fight Russia. Does he intend to see an end to this bloodshed and destruction that's happening in Ukraine and love life on both sides, or does he have another agenda on his mind?
Well, you know, when all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And all America has now is a military. That's what they've got to offer to the world, military intervention. So they are hoping that by stacking the cards against Russia, by dumping their latest weapons into the hands of untrained Ukrainians, many of whom do not want to fight, they think that they can defeat the Russian army when it's come to right the wrongs after eight straight years, as Tony mentioned, eight straight years of genocide against ethnic Russians in Ukraine. Well, they're absolutely wrong. And if the shoe were on the other foot, they would understand it. But nobody does to America what America does to the rest of the world. So they don't understand that when you're backed into a corner, when you're facing the prospect of nuclear weapons just minutes away from your capital city, when you've got the prospect of armies full of Nazis wearing World War II uniforms and swastikas at your borders, you have only one possible response, and that is to eliminate them. And that's what Russia is doing. And as Russia eliminates this forward front of the American military empire, they realize that where they are in those other countries, because of the same system that is failing America, failing the neo-Nazis in Ukraine, and failing the puppet comedian president every day in Ukraine. The Ukrainian people themselves are smarter than this, and they are going to stop it. They will probably remove Zelensky themselves.
Okay, Tony, we have almost 1 minute. If you could tell me briefly, would Europe be better off by further offering military and logistical aid to Kiev to keep fighting Russia, or rather by striving to encourage and facilitate dialogue between the two belligerent sides?
Well, look, of course, Europe would be far better off if we could see some sort of a peace deal in like the Minsk agreement in Ukraine, but it doesn't look as if the United States is going to allow Europe to do that, because of course we must understand that most of the force behind NATO is a United States force. Worth remembering, of course, that there were a couple of people involved, one specifically whose name escapes me. These are the leaders of NATO after the Second World War who had actually been in the SS during the war, Nazi leaders taking over as NATO leaders. So, of course, the Russians realize exactly who they're dealing with. But when it comes to what Europe should do, yes, of course, there should be a peace agreement. But I think many people in Britain are watching this battle going on a long way away and just wondering, what on earth does Boris Johnson think he's doing trying to fight somebody else's war in another part of the world when he's leaving his own people struggling to even feed their children? This is a message which is going down here. And of course, as I said, what we're seeing is more and more pushback, more and more people out on the streets and out on the roads actually protesting against this policy. So it may be that it's down to the British people to turn around this crazy government idea of carrying on with this war, because peace in Ukraine would mean a fantastic benefit for the whole of Europe, and that's afraid against the interests of the United States, and that's where we are. Europeans need to really get, I think, grow a pair and really start to stand up to the United States. We do not want, and we refuse to have, a U.S. war on European soil. Thank you very much. We're not going to put up with that.
Okay, and that's all the time we have. Tony Gosling in Brussel, John Bosnich in Belgrade, thank you so much for the contribution and insights.